I'm bored. What plaything can you offer me today?
An obscure body in the SK system, Your Majesty. The inhabitants refer to it as the planet Earth.
How peaceful it looks.
Most effective, Your Majesty. Will you destroy this Earth?
Later. I like to play with things a while. Before annihilation.
Alrighty, welcome everybody to another episode of The World's Gone Mad. I don't have a lot of articles today, but I have some clips that are a little bit longer today for you guys. I hope you're going to enjoy it. It's usually good stuff, I believe. The material is usually pretty alright. And to the point. Let's see what I have today. It is a Friday, the 19th of April. And we're heading already quickly towards the end of this month. Just a little bit more. But first this. Here we go. Then let's kick it off. We're gonna start with the most pressing topic at this moment, and they always create these things, we know that, but it is happening. And now apparently Russia is asking the UN to consider sanctions against Israel. Oh man, that is gutsy. A nation that always calls for sanctions against others, including their controlled America, who always put sanctions on people. And sanctions is basically a bit of a war crime, but you know, we know this happened a lot. You know, they did this with Germany when Mr. Mustache came to power. They completely quickly put sanctions on Germany, and you know, boycotts. It's pretty much similar. Boycotts. And Now let's see. Here we go. Russia asks UN to consider sanctions against Israel. Now, this is all very interesting because behind closed doors, they're great friends. You know, Putin is great friends with Netanyahu, so why would they even ask that? I guess it's all for show, but let's see. Russia's permanent representative to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, has called on the United Nations to consider imposing sanctions on Israel over its non-compliance with obligatory resolutions passed by the Security Council. Yeah, they don't give a fuck. They don't listen to anyone. He noted that the UNSC resolution 2728 demanded a ceasefire in Gaza during Ramadan, and this has not been implemented by Israel. They don't give a fuck. Netanyahu and his ilk, they don't give a fuck. Which doesn't benefit the people living in Israel either. So, that's going to be a pretty ugly situation. We remind you once again that non-compliance with mandatory Security Council resolutions must lead to sanctions against violators. We believe that the Council should consider this issue without delay. Nebenzia said on Thursday during a UN Security Council meeting. French Foreign Minister Stéphane Séjourn also called for sanctions on Israel earlier this month in February. Paris sanctioned 28 Israeli nationals through the French government, though the French government has not published their names. How do we know then? Well, we sanctioned them, but we're not going to tell who where is. The Hamas ceasefire resolution was adopted by the Security Council on March 25th in a vote of 14 in favor to none against. With the US, of course, you guessed it, abstaining. The document demanded a ceasefire in Gaza during Ramadan, the immediate and unconditional release of all hostages, and for humanitarian access to Gaza to be ensured. Delivery of the humanitarian aid to Gaza is nearly impossible at the moment, Nebazia said, pointing to data from the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, which demonstrates that Israel's defense forces, the IDF, are currently blocking half of the humanitarian convoys heading to the region. Earlier this month, Israel admitted that the IDF had mistakenly conducted a strike that the World Central Kitchen Group said killed 7 of the organization's personnel. 3 British nationals, an Australian, a Palestinian, a Pole, and a US Canadian. So they're not only killing Palestinians, they're now killing British, they're killing an Australian, they're even killing a Pole. They don't give a fuck. Shortly after the US abstained on the UN Gaza ceasefire resolution, Israel Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu cancelled a planned visit to Washington by a high-level delegation in protest over the move. He accused the White House of retreating from what he had said had been a principal position by allowing the vote to pass without attaching conditions providing for the release of hostages held by Hamas. Hamas raided nearby Israeli military bases and villages on October the 7th, killing more than 1,100 Israelis and taking over 200 hostages. Israel responded by declaring war on the group and invading Gaza. The military operation has reduced much of the enclave to rubble, claiming the lives of more than 33,000 Palestinians over the past 6 months. According to local authorities, a week-long truce deal reached in late November saw 105 hostages freed in exchange for 240 Palestinian prisoners. On Wednesday, Qatari Prime Minister Sheikh Mohammed bin Abdullah Rahman Al Thani said negotiations stalled between Israel and Hamas to secure a truce in Gaza and a release of more hostages. Right, there we go. That kicks this one off. Welcome, everybody. Thank you. You're listening to The World Gone Mad. We are reaching closely to 9 minutes now. Let's see if we have one more we can do for you. I have some more articles coming up, but and there is some clips attached, but let me first check, because probably this is a long clip which is attached to this maybe 1% of vision remains to this article here. There's bloody commercials, it's just so horrible.
Patrick Henningsen,
yes, 41 minutes, that is too long, my friends, but all right, that's good. Let's go to a clip. I need a clip. I need a break. I'm already tired of this show. I'm already tired. I just started, but I'm already tired. Now then, Webster Tarpley, oligarchies are the most tyrannical and destructive form of rule. Now, this is about 30 minutes, a little bit longer, so that should be doing all right. Yeah, this is very important stuff. So now we finally get to something crucial again. Like this year, I mentioned already,
mentality of oligarchy.
And I never did this before so much. Mentality. But yeah, this year I look back and I think, yeah, I really put out a really interesting bunch of documentaries right from the start of the new year, right in line with if you want to understand how the world's being run, how mind control works, how you're being manipulated, how you're being, you know, controlled in many ways. Through, for instance, the Tavistock Institute, through communist subversion and all these things, you can look back in my archives, go back to the beginning of the year. And it's not so even so much my shows, The World Gone Mad and all that stuff, but all the other extra documentaries that I posted. They are very fascinating. And if you put all that together, you get a pretty clear picture of what happened ever since the 60s and even beyond that. Now, I'm having myself a little bit of Aussie wine on a Friday night, and I deserve it. So we're going to listen to this clip. Oligarchies are the most tyrannical and destructive form of rule. All right, here we go.
The mentality of oligarchy does not change. We have to remember that as long as there are human individuals, you're going to have the one, the few, and the many. There's going to be one person, small groups of people, and large masses. So this is always going to be with you. These are ontological categories of human existence. The problem you have is if you have the dictatorship of the one, that's a fairly clear-cut problem. If you have the spontaneous mob of the many, that's a problem that people can also recognize. But what you tend to have in human civilization is the rule of the few, the oligarchy, the iron law of oligarchy, studied by German sociologists in the late 1900s. Now, the purpose of an oligarchy is really only one thing. A tyrant can have a project. A mob can have a goal. But an oligarchy is there to do one thing, to perpetuate oligarchy, to give it more and more power and allow it to exist. The mentality of oligarchy always depends on the idea that there's an elite and a mass, and there can't be anything in between. There's really no room for a middle class in oligarchy. So the elite has to justify itself based on what? Why should they rule? Are they smarter? Are they more efficient? Are they better? They're probably none of those things. They're probably inferior in many ways. So they've got to find other ways to justify what is an irrational principle of domination. So oligarchs generally find ways to argue that the mass of people are inferior, that their lives are not worth living, and indeed, that they're closer to animals than they are to the elite. So whenever you have an oligarchical elite, they're always going to try to portray the masses as ignorant beasts, inferior, or whatever else it is. And that's what we see. This is very strong in the Anglo-American world. The U.S.-British tradition is not that of a dictator. Stalin, Hitler, this you generally don't find. It's also not so much in the notion of mob rule and demagogy of that sort, although occasionally it is. Generally, what you have in terms of real power is an oligarchy. So this oligarchy is inherited from Venice, from the Venetian Republic of the Middle Ages, and it's transferred into Britain between 1500 and 1600 or so in the form of the Whig Party, the top aristocratic party, which rules Britain from the early 1600s, really, until about 1832 and the Reform Bill. So it's an oligarchical system. The U.S. and the British are a polycentric oligarchy where you can't say the Bilderberger runs it or the Trilateral or the CFR or Bohemian Grove or whatever it is. All of those are power centers that jostle each other and coexist. But what they amount to is an oligarchy. If you have a tyrant, you can convince the tyrant to change policy. It can be done. But to change an oligarchy, as Plato points out, is harder because you've got to convince so many different ones. And as soon as you convince some of them, you've deconvinced others because those are the enemies and they hate the ones that you've convinced. So that's the problem that we face in the Anglo-American world.
If you have scientific optimism, oligarchy is no longer tenable. So that's one side of it. But then there's the other side. The overpopulation seems to grow out of the quest of the oligarch to find a way to define other people as subhuman or non-human. If you look around, say, Italy, right, and you look at sculpture and things you can find out in the public squares. You'll see, as I would sum it up, the oldest oligarchical trick in the book, in humans and beasts, humans and animals. And one of the favorite themes of oligarchical sculptures and things like this is to have creatures that are part human, part animal. This is a very, very dangerous combination, right? You want to keep that as a bright line of demarcation, because in reality, there is one. But notice, as the oligarch, most people are more like animals than they are like me. The oligarch attempts to say that the common run of mankind, the average person, Joe Sixpack, is really an animal. But the oligarch, the people of wealth and family and whatever other criteria that they may want to drag out, these are inherently superior. So that the answer to the problem that this creates tends to be the extermination of the poor, the useless eaters, the lower classes, the inferior racial minorities, of course, always a favorite target, an obvious target in this. And again, this, we can trace this back at least 3,000 years. Hesiod, not quite 3,000 years, but we can more or less get three millennia of a structural feature. It looks like it's an ontological feature of oligarchical thinking, that the world is overpopulated, and that at the same time, technology is not available. The technology would be the wrong way to deal with this. So the oligarch says, if there are not enough hats, the answer is not to produce more hats, but to cut off heads.
The world is not overpopulated. There's tons and tons and tons and tons of space around the world. Where it is overpopulated, however, is a country like the Netherlands or Germany, Belgium, you know, France. Yeah, they have some space as well, but still. So they are overpopulated because we live here in this tiny space, right on top of each other, pretty much. And of course, our corrupt politicians are saying, "Well, there is tons of space, but it's because of land ownership, like farmers and other people who own lots of lands." And they don't like it. That's why they want to get rid of them, so they can give it to the refugees and newcomers. Yeah, then of course you have more space when you take away the land. But if you take away the means of production, self-production, you're completely dependent on the state, which is very, very dangerous. And what did the commies do? Who did they go after? Well, the religious, the Christians, mainly in Russia, and then of course the farmers. What's happening in the West? Where are they going after? The Christians and the farmers. Isn't that interesting?
And that's what you see. In the years after World War II, it was hard for oligarchs to come forward with this because of the class consciousness and sense of empowerment that had been developed in the New Deal. The fact that you had powerful labor unions, you had a mass-based Democratic Party in which these unions had at least some influence. But then as the 60s turned into the 70s and you get Vietnam, Watergate, the Carter administration, the deindustrialization begins, the decline of the living standard begins to come in. People have less and less resistance to forms of irrationalism. So that by the end of the 60s, you have things like the Club of Rome coming forward, the limits to growth, the Rio Report, and then a series of conferences, the Stockholm Conference of 1972. There was a Bucharest Conference on Population in Romania in 1973, I believe. And then the one that I attended, which was the World Food Congress in Rome in 1974, November. This was at the Food and Agricultural Organization, the FAO, and it was attended by Henry Kissinger. I remember sitting up in the balcony of this large hall at the EUR district of Rome. In comes Kissinger, surrounded by a crowd of about 100 sycophants, goons, and secretaries and co-workers and whatever. And Kissinger is there to give a speech about the world food supply. But the idea is, as we know from Kissinger's secret memorandum in the White House, is that the policy of the United States is that other countries must be prevented from using natural resources, and other countries must be prevented from using food stocks.
One of the most evil scumbags of the last 100 years or 80 years or whatever, because he was about this age, is Henry Kissinger. Awful. This guy has been behind so many things and has influenced American policy so much. It's horrible.
Because those are needed for the imperialist homeland. And that's bad enough. The world that we're in now has qualitatively degenerated because now we don't have the Cold War anymore. We have a kind of oligarchy, which is, I think, qualitatively more insane now than it was then. Because in those days, it was at least the Soviet Union.
You don't have the Cold War anymore, but the bloody Cold War has been won by Russia. Oh, they collapsed. Yeah, really. Well, that's what I said earlier in the show. Go and check out my documentaries, or not mine, but at least my my archives, and go back to the beginning of the year where I pretty much put a lot of emphasis on this whole communist, you know, takeover, this clever trick of, oh, we collapsed, there's no longer the Cold War, but in the meantime, look how communistic the US and Canada has become, and militaristic, and, you know. So, they definitely, in my opinion, won, but of course, it's a little bit more complex than that, but yeah, there's a lot to it, so if you want to know more about that, then you can check out in my archives, you can see the documentaries that I posted on that.
Represent a boundary and reality principle. Today, I think if you look at the United States, you'll see that there is a group of about 50 to 60 million people. Let's say it's about 60 million people or so, and it is therefore about one-fifth of the entire population, right? One in five, 20% of everybody in this country is, I think, in grave danger of measures that can only be called genocidal. And here's what I mean. The problem in the current form starts, of course, with the stagnation of the labor market. We haven't had full employment since 1945, really. And every recession we've had has left us with a higher and higher level of structural unemployment. And that really went on all through the 90s. And of course, we see it today, right? We have really unemployment today about 25% or more. My estimate is there are about 30 million Americans who really need a job and who can't get one. So depression level. This is a depression. This is as bad or worse than the depression of the 1930s. So you got these.
See, now that's interesting what he says there. It's as worse or maybe even more. But what is the greatest trick that they do? You hardly notice, you know. I mean, those people know, they feel it. And how is it possible with all this accumulated wealth and now, of course, the destruction of it all? But of course, America as a nation really wasn't so taking too much care of its citizens like they did in European nations, especially the Netherlands. Maybe they did too much in the Netherlands, but we're a little bit spoiled. But it's sad to see. And then they see all the tax-based money is being wasted. Millions and millions. They're giving $5 billion to Israel. Yeah. With this $5 billion, you could help all these people that have no job, you know? So it's really, you see how they play the game, what they do with it all. It's sad, and, you know. And then you realize that this cannot be. That there is solutions to these things. There have always been solutions. There's many great intelligence minds who have looked at this, who have calculated what you can do about it. And again, you know, you can take a look at the beginning of National Socialistic Germany, you know, whatever you think of it, if it was good or bad. They did perform, they did pull off an economic miracle where in 2 years' time, you know, the nation was prosperous again and was having one of the highest living standards in the world. I mean, so there is solutions to this banking scam, and we will get to that later. But anyway, let's listen about 4 more minutes.
50 million people. In previous decades, they might have exhausted their unemployment benefits, which they had gotten under the Social Security Act of 1935 as a result of all, you know, many, many decades of mass struggle. But along came Bill Clinton, and he decided that in order to make sure that he could get reelected in 1996, he would destroy one of the titles of the Social Security Act of 1935, which was aid to mothers with dependent children, that is welfare. And he essentially destroyed it. And what's left is something called TAMF, right? Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. There's a pittance, and it's very hard to get, and it doesn't...
Yeah, but at the same time, who's getting all that benefit money? You know, everyone who walks across the border there. I mean, it's infuriating. This is psychological warfare, ladies and gentlemen. This is how you pit one against the other. You know, instead of living in your country or in your community, you know, where you can sort things out yourself, you know, you don't need that much government control. You know, you let people, you leave people to their own devices. You make sure they pretty much get what they need. You keep a good relationship among each other as a government and, you know, the citizens. You know, you don't interfere too much. You let them do their thing. Things will be all right. You know, I'm pretty sure. I'm 100% sure of it. Things will be all right if the government acts like a responsible parent. We would have a very different world.
Really change anything in this picture. The abolition of welfare was the worst thing Clinton did. And there were people who resigned from his administration based on this treacherous act that he carried out. All the reactionary commentators say that the abolition of welfare has been a great success. It has not. It has created a permanent class of paupers. And these paupers are in extreme poverty. We've just had in the course of 2012, in the early part of the year, a series of statistics published about the degree of poverty that you find in these strata. You're talking about, you know, a family of four living on less than $12,000 a year. This is just unspeakable. It's not clear how anybody can do this, but somehow they've muddled through so far, but at what cost, right? And the cost is going to be seen in cognitive impairment of children who have been denied sufficient protein in their diets when they're very young. Now, that is barbarism, and it cannot be allowed. And there's no economic argument that can justify that. And there's no Austrian school hokum that can be allowed to justify that. So we've got 50 million people. They don't have jobs. The 30 million and their families, right? That's about what it is, or soon will be, and it'll be more. They don't have welfare anymore, thanks to Bill Clinton. And he didn't need to hurt people like that to get reelected. He could have defeated Dole without doing this. But as a new Democrat, he went ahead and did it. This has now created these 50 million people. Now, let's see what other problems they have. They don't have medical insurance. And the Republicans, when you look at this Obamacare question, Republicans, you know, they have their beefs about what they don't like in the Obama bill. And there's lots not to like in the Obama bill, right? The Obama bill has death panels. It has this MedPAC, medical permanent advisory committee that's going to ban technologies, and you're going to be told to die in order to defend the integrity of the system. Notice, though, the only difference between Republicans and Democrats is Democrats want to kill you with a board of people. The Republicans want to kill you through what they call the market. In other words, you'll be out there, you won't have the money for it, and you'll die that way. So this is not a very big difference. But all of these problems come to rest on the 50 million. The reason the Republicans want to abrogate and declare unconstitutional, if they can, the Obamacare is because they don't want people to get the idea again that they have a right to medical care. And of course, we've got Ron Paul out there telling you, you do not have a right to medical care. Well, I'm sorry. Americans do have a right to medical care. And it was proposed as one of the 8 points of the Franklin D. Roosevelt Economic Bill of Rights of 1944, that you have a right to a home, to an education, to health care, to a retirement. You have a right to social insurance. You have a right, if you're a farmer, not to be crushed by monopoly competition. If you're a small businessman, you have a right not to be crushed by Walmart or whatever it is. In other words, security. And people say, well, no, that interferes with my liberty. Remember, people that are needy are not free. Necessitous people destitute people are not free, cannot be free. And this is what the libertarians seem to have forgotten.
And will never be free, I have to add to that. Yeah, good stuff. All right, thank you. Welcome to the room. Thank you for joining World Gone Mad. We're going to go on with a little bit more. I got another video coming up later. We're going to do an article. I mean, these things, and also what's happening in Palestine, man, these things can happen to us too, very rapidly, if things go south, you know. It's hard to imagine. You cannot imagine that now. But once it happens, it happens. And then it will not be pretty. Okay, we go to the Netherlands now. Watch and shudder. The contempt that Rutte expresses here towards the Dutch population is total nonsense. Mark Rutte, he's still at the helm, still. While the formations are still ongoing, they can't form a formation, they cannot make a formation. They've been at it now for more than 170 days. This is completely ludicrous. And in the meantime, this guy is still there. Outgoing Prime Minister Rutte refuses to answer Pepijn van Houweling's questions in Parliament on Tuesday. The Prime Minister dives again. I find it really shocking, the MP said at one point. I really wonder who I'm debating with. Is this the Prime Minister or is this the future Secretary General of NATO? Van Houweling asked. It was his last interruption and also the end of the debate. I thank the Prime Minister for his presence, said Speaker of the House Bosma. He is already ready with his back to leave the building. World Economic Forum. Rutte laughed towards the house, at which great hilarity broke out. He laughs at us all, Van Houweling responded in the studio of a TV program, Unheard of News. Also the Dutch population, that's the bad thing. He knows he can get away with anything, he added. The contempt he expresses here towards the Dutch people, and we represent the Dutch people, is a total nonsense. Former PVV MP Harm Bertema wholeheartedly agreed with him. I think this is very bad. A prime minister like that, standing before us in our parliament, that is the highest authority we have in the Netherlands, who treats those parliamentarians in this way. I find it shocking. I find it truly disconcerting. The way he laughs at that, the way he provokes what the back, with that back from the new, from the World Economic Forum. Anyway, let's show it. And then the swagger. It really is swagger from an overconfident teenager. Chairman lets it happen, and the entire House lets it happen. When asked whether the House of Representatives still has supervisory function, political scientist Yanis Ramatizering replied, no, the quality of the MP is not that high across the board. Parties have all the power in the Netherlands. They determine the list. They do not want unwelcome opinions within their own ranks. So we have a lot of ghost or zombie parties. These are parties that have 20 to 30 seats and only three of them can say something. Out of 150, you might have 25 who can say something. During debates, only one or two from all groups are present. So this is how it can happen. Yeah. There is no democracy in this little nation. And I'm not even sure if democracy is the best thing. You know, they doubt it like it's the best thing in the world. But like Americans, you know, we're going to bring some democracy. Really. Well, they only brought poverty and destruction. And we know we are at it. We know who's really behind all that. It's not Americans themselves. But unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen. Unbelievable. Yeah. How is everybody doing? That's a good question. Anyway, you listen to The World Gone Mad with 34 minutes in. It always goes so quickly if you have some longer clips. Billions to Ukraine and asylum seekers. At the same time, many hundreds of millions in cuts to elderly care. This is how much they care about the Dutch people. This is what they want. They want the Dutch people to go. They want them gone. They want them out of here. The Frisians, the Friars, the Dutch. They don't have no place for them anymore. They don't want them around. But will we go? Elderly care is once again in danger of being confronted with major cuts. This year it will amount to 310 million euros. From next year it will structurally amount to 700 million euros, according to the Spring Memorandum. From 2026, the government has structurally booked over 750 million in cuts. It is a sensitive issue in the House of Representatives. But the outgoing cabinet believes that elderly care can be done with less money. Group leader of the Zwolle party, Zwolwacht, Sylvia Bruggenkamp, said, "It is really there. Unbelievable. How?" Yep, they're doing it. Billions to the Ukrainians and asylum seekers. At the same time, cuts in elderly care. Now, the elderly care already has been suffering. You know, people working in the care sector have been suffering. They've been working day and night. There's a shortage of staff. Whether you're employed within the elderly care or whether you're working, you know, freelance in the elderly care, you make good money, but it is hard work, ladies and gentlemen. You're caring for people that aren't even your relatives, you know. And a lot of them do it with a good heart. They do it because they care. That's why they're working in the care sector. Now, caring is love. Don't forget that. Of course, love is a word that has lost all its meaning. But to me, true caring is love. It's the closest thing to love. So, care is very important. But this is being destroyed for such a long time. What are we going to do? We have to think about these things quickly, because they're breaking it all down. It is claimed that billions in investment in weapons would be necessary to defend our democracy and our public prosperity. How does this fit with the simultaneous breakdown of democracy and prosperity? Smith receives support from Professor Elward Engelen. That's how it is. The war economy mainly serves the interests of the shareholders in the United States, and it is exposed. And at the expense of things that citizens really need and that they have stripped bare for 40 years. For what? To counter an imaginary threat and fuel to danger of escalation? Meanwhile, the Red Cross in the Netherlands has to raise money against food shortages. It is a shame. Billions are flying around your ears for this cabinet, but where are the billions to solve these problems? It is a political problem caused by the politicians, exacerbated by the politics in the recent years. Yep. This tiny little nation, the Netherlands, and still, amongst all the issues, we still have some of the higher standards of living, even though if you poke through it, there's a lot of things wrong with it. But yeah, now, because we're going pretty quickly on the timeline, I will play you the other clip that I was planning to put on here. And then I think I'm going to wrap it up. So, let's see. The greatest swindle. The origins and history of fiat currency and central banks. Again, these are the real topics that we should learn about. If we want to change things, I think these are key things to know. So, unplug the bananas from your ears, ladies and gentlemen. And listen to this. We're going to play this in a moment. The greatest swindle.
And I don't need to. to see anymore, to know that I can read your mind.
Alrighty then, ladies and gentlemen, let's play this final clip of this episode. The Greatest Swindle, the Origins and History of Fiat Currency and Central Banks. It's about 80 minutes, 18 minutes.
Five, three strange-looking men arrived at the port of Venice. Their ragged clothes and tanned faces indicated that they had come from afar. They spoke Italian, but with a heavy foreign accent. They had difficulty finding their way through the alleys, since the city had changed so much since they left it 24 years earlier. These were Marco Polo, his father Niccolo, and his uncle Maffeo, who returned from their long journey to the east. When they finally got home, their relatives could hardly recognize them. They marveled at the treasures they had brought with them, diamonds and gemstones the likes of which they had never seen. But they were even more amazed by the stories they had to tell of their adventures in the deserts of Persia and Afghanistan, and of the court of the Mongolian Emperor Kublai Khan. Is it possible that this event changed history forever? Could it be responsible for the economic trouble we are experiencing today? Several years after his return to Venice, Marco Polo was captured during a battle with the Republic of Genoa. During his time in prison, he described his adventures to his cellmate, who later published them in a book. His story depicts life in Imperial China during the Yuan Dynasty.
Now that there is already interesting. I mean, it's kind of interesting. I mean, how he told it to his cellmate. How did he remember every bit of it and then published it in a book, you know? And that's kind of like a little bit questionable, you know. But anyway, let's continue.
Among other things, it mentions the monetary system which was introduced by Kublai Khan. It was based on paper notes stamped with his royal seal. When the Venetians first heard this story, they dismissed it as fantasy. They found it hard to believe that anyone would be willing to accept payment in worthless pieces of paper instead of gold or silver coins. Nevertheless, this is probably how the idea of using paper money came to Europe. This method probably stems from the habit of Chinese merchants at the time to deposit their gold coins at a secured warehouse. In exchange for the gold, they received a document which confirmed that a certain amount was deposited in their name. The merchants soon realized that for large transactions, it was easier to exchange the receipts than to physically go to the warehouse and exchange the coins. At first, all parties involved knew that the paper note was nothing more than a receipt.
Basically, they're saying they're a bunch of lazy bastards.
And that the real money was deposited at the vault. But as time went on, people grew accustomed to the convenience of using paper notes and forgot that they weren't real money. During the Renaissance, along with the rise of an urban middle class, banking began to develop in Europe. More and more people were no longer serfs in the service of a feudal lord, and instead became successful merchants and craftsmen. Those who managed to accumulate some wealth wanted to invest it, and those who wanted to expand their business required loans. The banks that began to appear throughout Italy were designed to serve both needs. They borrowed from the former in the short term and lent to the latter in the long term, profiting from the difference in interest rates. This business model proved itself to be extremely lucrative. Some of these bankers, such as the Medici family from the city of Florence, became very rich and powerful, both financially and politically. Just as happened in China, people found it easier to conduct their business with paper notes. It greatly reduced the risk of robberies. It also facilitated the transfer of funds across great distances. Merchants were no longer required to carry with them large amounts of gold as they traveled from country to country. Instead, they could use paper notes, which were honored by other branches of the bank all across the continent. This facilitated trade and helped the economy grow, but it also introduced a new kind of risk called the counterparty risk. People were no longer holding the physical gold in their hands. If for some reason the bank went under, they could lose their money. But the use of paper notes had an even more insidious side effect. There was a huge temptation for the banks to issue more notes than there was gold in their vaults. This way they could loan out more money and earn more interest. Since most customers trusted the bank and only rarely asked to withdraw their gold, this fraud could be kept secret. We call this devious practice fractional reserve banking, and at the time it was illegal. Since the public treated the banknotes as if they were gold coins...
Well, usury pretty much was forbidden in the Christian worlds, and we were at some point a Christian world, and it still happened, unfortunately.
There was more money in circulation, chasing the same amount of goods. The artificial expansion of the money supply generated inflation, and as a result, prices started creeping up. The scam was only revealed if too many customers showed up at the same time and demanded their gold. If the bank was unable to grant their request, panic would ensue. The news that a certain bank was insolvent would quickly spread across town. Hundreds of angry customers would rush in, demanding to receive their money. We call such an event a run on the bank. It led to the collapse of numerous banks and sent their disgraced owners to prison. Back in the day, the fear of a bank run was the only thing keeping bank owners from issuing an unlimited amount of banknotes, producing an unlimited amount of inflation. Whenever a bank collapsed and its paper bills lost all value, there was a sudden contraction of the money supply, which we call deflation. This often led to a recession, because the citizens who lost their savings had to cut back on their spending, and this had a negative impact on the entire economy. Eventually, the authorities became aware of these destructive cycles of inflation and deflation and tried to stop them. During the 17th century, central banks began to appear throughout Europe. Their original purpose was to supervise the commercial banks and, in case of an emergency, provide them with liquidity and prevent their collapse. Among them, we can mention the Bank of Amsterdam, which was established in 1609, and the Central Bank of Sweden,
But who was behind all this banking business?
In 1968. But the institution which most inspired today's central bank is undoubtedly the Bank of England. Many times in history, developments in the financial system are the result of some kind of crisis. In 1694, King William III of Great Britain found himself in financial difficulty. He needed a large sum of money in order to finance the ongoing war against France, and none of the banks in London was willing to lend him the necessary amount, not even for a hefty interest rate of 8%. Therefore, his Chancellor of the Exchequer, Charles Montague, devised a plan, according to which a cartel of banks would be established. This cartel would manage the government's accounts and grant it loans, and in return receive the exclusive right to issue banknotes in the United Kingdom. In other words, the right to issue paper money was taken away from the free market and granted to a few privileged bankers, protected by the government. As we can see, central banks were originally established as private institutions, whose purpose was to protect the interests of the banks. Over the centuries, the boundaries between them and the government became blurred. Nowadays, they are considered as an organ of the state, whose role is to maintain the stability of the economy. However, compared to other government agencies, they enjoy a high degree of independence. Their members are unelected, and their policy is not subject to public scrutiny. Their authority to create new money gives them enormous power. And in the past decade, we have seen how they abuse this power, hurting the savers and exacerbating the inequality between the rich and the poor. Do you think that the establishment of central banks put an end to the nefarious practice of fractional reserve banking? On the contrary, it only formalized it and made it legal. The members of the banking cartel were officially allowed to grant loans in excess of their capital, and they happily took advantage of it. They were no longer afraid of issuing too many loans, because they knew that in the event of a bank run, the central bank would come to their rescue. Supposedly, in such a system, there is no limit on the amount of banknotes that can be printed, and on the amount of inflation that can be created. This could potentially put the central bank in danger. If too many citizens appeared all at once, demanding to convert their notes into gold, the central bank itself could collapse. Therefore, it had to put a limit on the amount of credit that the member banks were allowed to issue. This was done through a mechanism called the reserve ratio, which set a certain ratio between the amount of reserves each bank held at the central bank and the amount of loans it was allowed to give. By dialing the reserve ratio up and down, the central bank was able to regulate the total amount of credit in the system and theoretically put a lid on inflation. The monetary system we've just described is known as the gold standard. It allowed for a certain amount of inflation and therefore was far from perfect. But as long as the government kept a balanced budget, and the central bank didn't monetize its debt, the rate of inflation was tolerable. Countries which implemented this system usually enjoyed a robust rate of growth, which balanced the inflation and allowed the citizens to prosper. Backing the currency with gold, even if only partially, helped stabilize its value and protect the savings of the citizens. Under the gold standard, Britain went through the Industrial Revolution, grew stronger, and became an empire. During this period, the pound sterling was the global reserve currency. And if Britain hadn't abandoned the gold standard during World War I, it would perhaps remain dominant till this very day. After World War II, the United States took over the role of the leading superpower, and the dollar became the global reserve currency. According to the terms of the Bretton Woods Agreement, the dollar was supposed to be backed by gold, and other nations were supposed to hold dollar reserves. This way, their currencies would indirectly be backed by gold as well. However, during the 1950s and 60s, the federal government had abused its power, spent too many dollars, and issued too much debt. Inflation started to pick up. The United States trading partners became concerned that there wasn't enough gold in Fort Knox in order to back all the dollars in circulation. Led by France, they started converting their dollar reserves into gold, and the United States gold reserves gradually declined. This was tantamount to a run on the bank, only on a global scale. Afraid that the U.S. may run out of gold, President Richard Nixon decided to put an end to this. On August 15, 1971, he gave a televised address in which he announced his decision to suspend the convertibility of the dollar into gold. The implications of this event, which is now known as the Nixon Shock, were not fully understood at the time, but in retrospect, it severed the last connection between the dollar and gold, ushering in the era of fiat currencies. Since central banks are no longer obliged to back their currencies with gold, they can manufacture them in any amount they deem necessary. There is also no restriction on the amount of credit that commercial banks can give to their customers. As a matter of fact, after 2008, the reserve requirements which we mentioned earlier became largely irrelevant, and in 2020 they were cancelled altogether. This is the greatest swindle in human history. While we the people need to work hard for our money, the banking system can simply print it out of thin air, and then charge interest on it. It allows the government to gradually siphon away the purchasing power of our savings without us being aware. Until recently, most of the newly created money flowed into assets such as stocks, bonds, and real estate, and the prices of commodities stayed relatively tame. This benefited mainly the rich, because they own the vast majority of these assets. But since 2020, the flow of money has shifted. All of the liquidity which was created in the past decades is threatening to spill into the commodity sector, pushing up the prices of consumer goods and making the cost of living unbearable. It is becoming clear that the current monetary system is unsustainable, and that sooner or later it will collapse on its own. The only question is what kind of system will replace it. Will our leaders see the error of their ways and once again back the currency with some kind of tangible good? Or, in a desperate attempt to preserve their power, try to launch yet another fiat currency? I believe that by holding physical gold and silver, we the citizens can force them to do the right thing.
All right.
Thank you for listening to the...
It's all a hoax, people. They're just fucking with you. Well, that was it for today. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for joining. Have a good day out there. Thank you for downloading. Stay good out there. I'll be back later at some other time. Have a good day out there.
If there's a God or any kind of justice under the sky, if there's a point, if there's a reason to live or die, If there's answers to the questions we feel bound to ask, show yourself, destroy our fears, release your mask. Oh, we'll keep on trying. Tread that fine line. Smiling to the end of time.